Today, property prices, they are a-falling. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 13th of October 2018, our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. This week saw major fluctuations on the financial markets, which may be just a short-term issue or a signal of more disruption ahead. And locally, the latest data reveals a slowing of lending to first-time buyers and owner-occupied borrowers, suggesting more home price weakness ahead. So let's get stuck in. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to continue to make great content. The link is in the comments below. Let's look at property first. The IMF's latest Global Financial Stability Report says that Australia is one of a number of advanced economies where rising home prices are seen as a risk. They say household leverage stands out as a key area of concern, with the ratio of household debt to GDP on an upward trajectory in a number of countries, especially those that have experienced increases in home prices, notably Australia, Canada, and the Nordic countries. Housing market valuations are relatively high in several advanced economies. Valuations based on the price-to-income and price-to-rent ratios, as well as mortgage costs, have been on the upswing over the past 6 years across major advanced economies, with valuations relatively high in Australia, Canada, and the Nordic countries. And they also warn that the effect of monetary policy tightening, i.e. lifting interest rates to more normal levels, could reveal financial vulnerabilities. Indeed, it's worth looking at expected central bank policy rates globally. Bloomberg has mapped the relative likelihood of increases and decreases across a number of major economies, and most advanced economies are on their way up. Worth thinking about when we look at the long-term home price trends across the globe. Guess where Australia sits? High debt in a rising interest rate environment is not a good look, so expect more stress in the system. And yet, the latest RBA Financial Stability Review that was out last Friday seems, well, in a different world. They go out of their way to downplay the risks in the system and claim that households are doing just fine based on analysis driven by the rather old Hilda data again. But back in the real world, CoreLogic's auction results for last week returned an aggregated clearance rate of 49.5%, a small improvement on the week prior to 45.8% of homes sold, which was the lowest weighted average result since 42% in June 2012. There was a significantly higher volume of auctions, with 1,817 held, rising from the 895 over the week prior. Melbourne's final clearance rate fell last week to 51.8%, the lowest seen since 50.6% in December 2012. And there were 904 homes taken to auction across the city. Compared to 1 year ago, the Melbourne auction market was performing very differently, with both volumes and clearance rates significantly higher over the same period at 1,119 auctions and 70.3% sold. Sydney's final auction clearance rate increased last week, with 46.1% of the 611 auctions held clearing, up from 43.8% the week prior, when a similar volume of auctions was held. 1 year ago, Sydney's clearance rate was 61.3% across 818 auctions. And across the smaller auction markets, Canberra returned the strongest final clearance rate of 64.6% last week, followed by Adelaide, where 62.3% of homes sold, while only 11.1% of Perth homes sold last week. Looking at the non-capital city regions, the Geelong region was the most successful in terms of clearance rates, with 48.5% of the 41 auctions recording a successful result. And this week, CoreLogic is tracking 1,725 auctions across the combined capital cities, which is slightly lower than last week. Compared to 1 year ago, the volumes are down 30%. So last year it was 2,525. They also highlighted the growing settlement risk relating to off-the-plan high-rise sales. Prospective buyers may sign a contract to purchase from the plan, but when the unit is ready, perhaps 1 or 2 years later, a bank mortgage valuation may not cover the purchase price. That means the buyer may be unable to complete the transaction. And CoreLogic says that in Sydney, 30% of off-the-plan unit valuations were lower than the contract price at the time of settlement in September, double the percentage from a year ago. In Melbourne, 28% of off-the-plan unit settlements received a valuation lower than the contract price. And in Brisbane, where unit values remain 10.5% below their 2008 peak, the proportion was substantially higher at 48%. And they also argue that loss-making resales are rising, especially in the unit sector, although it does vary by location. The latest housing finance figures from the ABS show that lending flows for owner-occupied buyers appeared to be following the lead from the investment sector. Both are down. This is consistent with our household surveys. Looking at the original first-time buyer data, the number of new loans fell from 9,614 in July to 9,534 in August, a fall by 80 or 0.8%. As a proportion of all loans written in the month, the share by first-time buyers fell from 18% to 17.8%. Looking at the trend lending flows, the only segment of the market which was higher was a small rise in refinanced owner-occupied loans. These existing loans accounted for 20.5% of all loans written, up from 20.3%. And we see a rising trend since June 2017 from a low of 17.9%. Total lending was $6.3 billion, up $31 million from the last month. Investment loan flows fell 1.2% from last month, accounting for $10 billion worth, down $120 million. And owner-occupied loans fell 0.6% in trend terms, down $81 million to $14.5 billion. 41% of loans, excluding refinance loans, were for investment purposes, the lowest for years, from a high of 53% in January 2015. And on these trends, remembering that credit growth begats home price growth, the reverse is also true. Prices will fall further. The question remains how fast and how far. We will be revising our scenarios shortly. The latest weekly indices from CoreLogic shows price falls in Sydney down 0.16%, Melbourne down 0.18%, Brisbane down 0.08%, Adelaide down 0.09%, and Perth down 0.38%. giving a five cities average of down 0.18%. Morgan Stanley revised their house price forecasts down. They say, "We struggle to see any improvement in our components over the next year. We now see a 10 to 15% peak to trough decline in real house prices from 5 to 10% previously, which would mark the largest decline since the early 1980s. With households two times more leveraged to housing than back then, the impact on housing equity would be larger again." This downgrade, they say, largely reflects the downturn's extended length, as we expect the relatively orderly declines to date will continue. However, they go on to say, an acceleration of declines is our bear case, and we will continue to monitor stress points, including arrears trends. Strong employment growth and temporary migration has helped contain reported vacancy rates thus far, but we see a sustained overbuild into 2019 weighing on rentals. And NAB's latest quarterly property survey index fell sharply in the third quarter to the lowest level in 7 years. Sentiment was dragged lower by big falls in New South Wales and Victoria. And NAB's view is the orderly correction in home prices will continue over the next 18 to 24 months, with Sydney falling around 10% peak to trough and Melbourne 8%. This, they say, reflects a bigger fall than previously expected, but would still leave home prices well up on 2012 levels. Their central scenario does not include a credit crunch event leading to disorderly falls in house prices, they say. And they also say the boom in Australian real estate sales to foreign investors has run its course, with NAB's latest survey results continuing to highlight a decline in foreign buying activity resulting from policy changes in China on foreign investment outflows and tighter restrictions on foreign property buyers in Australia. In Q3, there were fewer foreign buyers in the market for Australian property, with their market share falling to a 7-year low of 8.1% in new housing markets and a survey low of 4.1% in existing established housing markets. So expect the calls for an increase in migration and a freeing of lending standards to reach fever pitch. Both of these must be ignored. We have to get back to more realistic home price ratios despite the pain. So it was interesting to note that the New South Wales state government this week suggested that migration needed to slow to provide breathing space and for infrastructure to catch up. Better late than never, I guess. Remember, the 2016 census revealed that Australian population increased by 1.9 million people. That's up 8.8% in the 5 years to 2016, driven by a 1.3 million increase in people born overseas, i.e. new migrants. We published our latest household survey data this week. Mortgage stress rose again to cross the 1 million households for the first time ever. We discussed the results in full in our post, Mortgage Stress Breaks 1 Million Households. The latest RBA data on household debt to income to June reached a new high of 190.5, and this high debt level helps to explain the fact that mortgage stress continues to rise. Across Australia, more than 1,003,000 households are estimated now to be in mortgage stress, compared with 996,000 last month. This equates to 30.6% of owner-occupied mortgage borrowers. In addition, more than 22,000 of these are in severe stress, and we estimate that more than 61,000 households risk 30-day default in the next 12 months. We continue to see the impact of flat wages growth, rising living costs, and higher real mortgage rates. Bank losses are likely to rise a little ahead. Moody's released a report suggesting that mortgage delinquencies and defaults are more likely to occur in outer suburbs of Australian cities than inner city areas because of the lower average incomes and weaker credit characteristics in these suburbs. Delinquency rates are highest in outer suburban areas. On average across Australian cities, mortgage delinquency rates are lowest in areas within 5 kilometres of central business districts, and highest in areas 30 to 40 kilometres from CBDs. In the residential mortgage-backed securities they rate, delinquency rates are in many cases higher in deals with relatively large exposure to mortgages in outer areas. Now, we agree that there are high loan-to-value and debt-to-income ratios in those outer areas, but the overall debt commitments are higher closer in. And so we suspect that many more affluent households are going to get caught because of multiple mortgages, including investment mortgages, and their more affluent lifestyles. My thesis is that the banks have been lending loosely to these perceived lower-risk, high-income households, but it ain't necessarily so. We also published our Household Financial Confidence Index. The latest read to the end of September shows a further fall and continues the trend which started to bite in 2017. The current score is 88.4, just a bit above the all-time low point of 87.69, which was back in 2015. Last month, August, it stood at 89.5. You can watch our video, Household Financial Confidence Drifts Lower Again, where we discuss the results. We expect to see the index continuing to track lower ahead because the elements which drive the outcomes are unlikely to change. Home prices will continue to move lower, the stock markets are off their highs, wages are hardly growing, and the costs of living are rising. So household financial confidence is set to remain in the doldrums. Finally, we also published our survey results in terms of forward intentions. So what is in store for the next few months? Well, in short, it's more of the same, only more so, with more households reporting difficulties in obtaining finance, fewer expecting to transact in the next year, and to see home prices rise. You can watch our video, Decoding Property Buying Intentions, where we analyse the results. The single most startling observation is the fall in the number of property investors, including those who hold portfolios of investment properties intending to transact. 20% of portfolio investors are expecting to transact, and the bulk of these intend to sell a property, compared with a year ago when 50% said they would transact and more were looking to add to their portfolios. Most solo property investors are now on the sidelines, with around 10% expecting to transact and most of these on the sell side. Demand for investment property will continue to fall as rental yields and capital appreciation falls. And so to the markets. Locally, the ASX 100 ended the week well down, although there was a small rise on Friday after the heavier falls earlier in the week. We ended at 4,849, up 0.20%. The local volatility index remains elevated, ending at 20.4 on Friday, although that was 6.5% lower than the previous day. Expect more volatility ahead. The ASX Financials Index, however, did less well and ended at 5,744, up just 0.03% and below the June lows. The banking sector is under pressure. For example, Macquarie ended at 115.5, up 0.03% on the day, but well down from its 125 range. And AMP continues to languish at 3.05. We heard from some of the major banks' CEOs this week, with Westpac and ANZ apologising for the issues revealed in the Royal Commission. But I also note that CBA has so far only addressed one of the many issues which APRA agreed with them in terms of behavioural remediation. The banks have got a long way to go to regain trust, and we expect more weakness ahead. And the latest estimates are that the sector will be up for something like $2.4 billion in remediation costs and other charges. And guess who will end up paying for their bad behaviour? The Aussie ended the week at 71.10, having reached the 70.5 range in the week. This has more to do with the US dollar movements than changes in sentiment here, I think. There was an amazing week in the US with significant falls, and we discussed this in our post, A Quick Update on the US Market Overnight, and our video, Another Sea of Red. There are debates about what caused the significant falls. After all, the Fed rate lift strategy and the trade wars have been around for some time. But my guess is the market has finally understood the era of low-cost or no-cost money is over. Thus, expect more volatility ahead. The US Fear Index fell back on Friday, down 13.8% to 21.31, but it is still elevated. And in fact, Wall Street indices rose on Friday after a week of significant losses as investors returned to technology and other growth sectors, but gains were hampered by ongoing worries about US-China trade tensions and rising interest rates. Energy and financial stocks continue to fall, and bank stocks kicked off the third quarter financial reporting session with a whimper, while investors fled insurance stocks after Hurricane Mitchell slammed into Florida. The technology sector was the biggest gainer of the S&P's 11 major industry indices, with a 1.5% advance, but it was still on track for its biggest weekly drop since March. The Dow Jones ended up 1.5% to 25,340, but is well off its recent highs. The Nasdaq was up more than 2.29% to 7,497 as buyers came back into the sector. The S&P 500 ended up 1.37% to 2,765. All three indices were on track for their biggest weekly declines since late March. The S&P Financial Index was down 0.42% to 465.07 on mixed trading results, which came out on Friday. The S&P 500 banks subsector slid 1.6%. The biggest drag on the subsector was JP Morgan Chase & Co., which reversed early gains to trade down 2% despite its quarterly profit beating expectations. PNC Financial led the percentage losers among the bank stocks with a 6.5% drop after the regional bank reported disappointing quarterly loan growth and said it expected only a small improvement in lending this quarter. The only gainers among banks were Citigroup, which rose 0.6%, and Wells Fargo, which eked out a 0.64% gain after upbeat results.
Yes, I think what we have to look at is so far the numbers are coming in line to slightly better than expected. As you've already highlighted, one of the standout areas has been credit. The credit quality for the banking industry remains very strong, and that showed up in everybody's numbers today. I'd also point out the other area that held in was the net interest margin. Most banks reported in line to slightly better margins, so the interest rate environment right now is working favorably for the banks.
The markets division and the investment banking story is really quite mixed and complex, Gerard. I'd love your read on it. It looks like equities is doing okay, both in trading and underwriting, and debt not so much. Is that going to be an industry theme, an industry-wide theme?
It's interesting because the two big banks that reported today reported opposite results in equity trading. When you look at the year-over-year growth, JP Morgan had very strong growth. On the other hand, Citi did not. They both had down trading, though, in FIC. So I think that's going to be consistent this quarter across the investment banks. And then on the ECM and DCM, that was also mixed. But ECM, generally, the equity capital markets should be stronger because of the strength of the IPO market and secondary market in the third quarter of this year.
Gerard, net income is flying, but there's still some people out there that say this is as good as it gets. Charles Peabody, a peer of yours at Portales, has downgraded JP Morgan this week and says the following: the company is at peak profitability for this cycle. I believe JPM stock is overvalued. There's at least 10% downside risk in the short term, and it could get a whole lot worse from there. What's your view on where this is going? And if this is peak profitability for this cycle, what it means for the stock prices of these banks?
It's really a matter of timing. The question is, will this peak profitability remain this way for another 6 to 8 quarters, or is it just now we're here at peak and it's going to start to come down? And I don't think it's going to come down over the near term. So if the U.S. economy continues to grow in 19 at 3% real GDP or better, the banks will be able to maintain this peak profitability well into 2020. So I think it's a little too early to get off the bank trade.
The bank results launch a quarterly reporting season that will give the clearest picture yet of the impact on profit from President Donald Trump's trade war with China. The short-term three-month Treasury remained flat at 2.27 at the end of the week, while the 10-year bond rose a little to 3.165, up 1.09%. The Treasury yield is now at a seven-year high. The suspicion is that perhaps rates have turned and will go higher still, as a longer-term view shows. And it's also interesting to compare the US three-month bill rate minus the same rates in Germany and the UK. Short-term rates in the US are higher, in fact, reaching the highest positive difference since September 1984. This highlights the different paths now being taken by the US, but the fallout will be global. Gold, which had moved higher among the market ructions, slid a little and was down 0.52% on Friday to end at 1,221, and Bitcoin finished at 6,316, up 0.57%, and continues in its narrow range for now. And oil, which had fallen higher in the week, moved up 0.72% to 71.48. Finally, it's worth noting that the Reserve Bank of New Zealand is now publishing a bank-specific set of scorecards to help consumers weigh up the risks bank to bank. This is essential given the now explicit deposit bail-in which exists there. We discussed this most recently in our post, The Never-Ending Bail-In Scandal, and in the video that economist John Adams and I released yesterday. In fact, the bank-specific data, which is available in Australia, is derisible compared with the New Zealand stats. But I came across this slide from LF Economics, which highlights how the ratio of bank loans to bank deposits compared across a number of banks, including the big Australian four. It's fair to assume the higher the ratio, the greater the potential risk. Westpac, CBA, NAB and ANZ are all in the top half. I believe we need more specific disclosure from the sector, and I suggest that APRA continues to provide only a partial view of the banking system here. The fact is, bail-in or no, we need much more transparency. And it would help to negate the spin presented in the RBA's financial stability review, which, in my view, is not effective. Oh, and look out for our joint video on gold coming up in the next few days. It will surprise you. Finally, a reminder that on Tuesday, the 16th of October at 8 p.m. Sydney, we are running our next live stream question and answer event. The reminder is up on YouTube, and you can send me questions beforehand or join in the live chat. So mark your diaries. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider joining our Patreon program, where you can support our ability to make great content. The link is in the comments below. As always, if you like what you've seen here today, please share and like the post and add a comment or question. I read them all. And if you want to join the growing band of subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now by hitting that subscribe bell. And if you've subscribed already, many thanks. I really appreciate your support and participation. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.